This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Factors. For example, while location in a bucolic setting has long been a selling point, those rural environments can also mean a smaller pool of applicants to draw from. Also, luxury amenities like fancy gyms and apartment-like dorms are becoming common at larger universities, but it's harder for small colleges to pay for major upgrades. On top of all this, the so-called STEM fields are trendy now: science, technology, engineering, and math, while the benefits of a classic liberal arts education are increasingly questioned as not very useful for the real world. So how do New Hampshire's small colleges survive and thrive in this new landscape? Well, that's what we're talking about today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. With me in studio is President Susan Stubner. She's the new president of Colby Sawyer College in New London. She just took office July 1st. Previously, she was executive vice president and chief operating officer at Allegheny College in Pennsylvania. And President Stubner, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much, Laura.
Also with us, President-elect Kim Mooney. She's the incoming president of Franklin Pierce University. She's also a Franklin Pierce alumna, previously provost and vice president for academic affairs, and served on the board of trustees. And President-elect Mooney, it's great to meet you, too.
Thank you
for being here. Joining us from D.C. is Scott Carlson. He's a senior writer with the Chronicle of Higher Education. And Scott Carlson, welcome back. It's good to have you on The Exchange.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, Scott, just a couple big picture questions for you first, please. So when we say small college, what do we mean? How small is small?
Well, there's no real definition, a set definition for what a small college is. I believe if you go to one of these the college organizations in the United States called NYCU, they say that about 30% of the colleges out there are 1,000 students or less. And, you know, what financial people talk about all the time is what's sort of the cutoff point for a college being financially sustainable with the number of students that it has? Are you really endangered if you have less than 500 students? Are you really endangered if you have less than 1,000 or 1,500? It's sort of this metric that these financial experts look at all the time, but I'm not sure that there really is sort of a definition there that you can apply to all colleges. You know, for example, we've had colleges close in the past several months here that have had 2,000 students. We've had colleges close in the past several months that have had less than 200. So, but I guess generally around 1,000 students would be a small college.
So there's no real agreement yet, Scott, on how small might be too small, but there are some, you know, serious financial considerations that you have to take into account.
That's right, because the smaller the college is, the less sort of margin of error it has when trying to float the boat, so to speak. Larger institutions have more students that can support more programs. They also have more students to support more administrative needs. So, for example, the federal government imposes a number of regulatory requirements, and to meet those regulatory requirements, you often have to have administrators working in places to do the paperwork, serve the students, and so on. With more students, you have more people there to serve the students that are there. If you're a college of 200 students, 300 students, like say Marlborough College in Vermont or Sterling in Vermont, there are just fewer people there to provide some of these services and also provide some of the academic programming.
So nationally, Scott, how many colleges roughly are really struggling, really having a hard time or even closing up shop in recent years? I think Moody's has looked at this, right? The financial analytical firm on Wall Street.
I don't know that there are hard numbers out there on how many will close. I mean, there are folks out there who work in, say, the ed tech sector who make these grand predictions saying, for example, you know, by 2030, 50% of the colleges will be out of business and so on. But those kinds of predictions are mainly self-serving. I mean, these are folks in the ed tech sector who basically want to take over the higher education sector and turn it into a for-profit industry. But there are a number of – we've seen a number of colleges in the past few months or past several months here close. Burlington College, right up there near New Hampshire, was one. It was a college that had fewer than 200 students in it. It made a sort of a bad land deal, it couldn't handle the debt on the land deal in the past several years and sort of fell under the weight of that. There was also Dowling College in Long Island, which announced its closure some months ago, and then now has sort of popped back up again. It's not clear whether it will survive, but it had about 2,000 students. There was also St. Catherine's College in Kentucky, which had about 500 students, which announced its closure. And before that, one notable example was Sweetbriar College in Virginia. It was a women's college. It also announced that it would close. It had a $100 million endowment. It was a named college. People had heard of it, which made it very surprising. It announced its closure, and then the alumni rallied and took control of the wheel, so to speak, and restarted the college, but with many fewer students. So it's yet to be seen whether that college will actually survive in the long run.
Well, and Scott, I've got a chart here in front of me from the New Hampshire Department of Education that is a list of closed colleges and universities here in New Hampshire, and there's, gosh, more than a dozen. But here's what I notice. A bunch of them opened in the 60s, and a bunch closed in the 70s. But then you don't really see a lot of closures until just the last couple of years, 2012, 2014, 2016. What's been happening in recent years, Scott, that's driving the closure or the real struggles anyway of some of these smaller colleges?
Well, let me go back for a moment. Back in the 60s and 70s, what was happening was there were a number of experimental colleges that were popping up because of the sort of mood of the times. And many of them were founded on sort of these ideals, and they didn't survive. One that did survive was College of the Atlantic in Maine, again up there in New England, and is doing pretty well, even though it has less than 300 students. What's happening recently is that I think the main symptom of what's happening to the colleges is that, you know, the prices for the colleges have been going up. That's one thing. But we've had an erosion of middle-class wealth over the past couple of decades. And that is just making it harder and harder for families to afford to send kids not just to private colleges, but to public colleges as well. I mean, there are even though the price tag on public colleges is lower than it is on private colleges, many of the private colleges offer lots of financial aid and can be competitive with the price on a public college. But really, the tuition prices and fees price is just one thing. There's also the cost of living at these various colleges, whether you're going to a public or private, and it's just harder for families to be able to afford that in one shot.
The phone number for you to join us in the exchange as we look at small colleges, big challenges this hour, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, 1-800-892-6477. I want to turn to you next, President Stubner, because not only are you the new president of Colby Sawyer College in New London, but you also did your PhD on this very topic, how to manage a small college. What are some of the challenges that you see for small colleges right now?
Thanks, Laura. I think one of the big challenges facing small colleges, many of them are located in New England or also the Midwest, where we're seeing the demographics of high school students projected to decline for the next really 8, 9, 10 years. And so the pool of students that were coming to our colleges has really shrunk. And so not only are we competing with other privates, but we're also competing with the publics in more ways than we used to in the past. And so looking to find new markets, being able to articulate our value, being able to stress the value of the liberal arts in a really a consumer market where the focus is on now and what can you do for the next step. Those are some, I think, really the main challenges that we're facing right now.
Well, and your demographic point is really interesting because you're right. New England and the Midwest are where a lot of these places are located, mm-hmm. and that's where we've seen a young adult demographic drain. So.
Absolutely. One of the most compelling maps I saw is when I used to be in Pennsylvania, it had over 300 private colleges, but it was also one of the states with the biggest decline in students. And so it just accentuates that competition we're facing right now.
I'd love to hear from you too, President-elect Mooney, especially on this point that President Stubner makes, that right now it seems to be all about STEM, mm-hmm. science, technology, engineering, and math. I wonder what you are hearing from students and parents when it comes to, okay, what good is this classic liberal arts education? I need a job right out of college.
Right. And we understand that the value proposition is probably one of our biggest challenges as small private institutions. But the value proposition isn't just about affordability. It is about what families think their student will gain from attending that college, that institution, that university. So our work as presidents, as provosts, as administrators, as faculty, is to be able to articulate the value proposition. So we know from national survey data that the number one reason students choose a college or a university is to get a better job. It used to be because they were thinking about learning and, you know, broadening their horizons. That's still in the top five, but it really is about that job at the end of those 4 years. So as a university, as a college, articulating the values and also letting people know how well your graduates do after they leave is really important, not just because of wonderful internship opportunities they might have had that have placed them in positions quickly, but also about opportunities over a lifetime. And so we know from, again, national survey data that students who graduate with a liberal arts or a liberal education degree really have an employability dimension that other students might not.
That's really interesting mm-hmm. to hear. And they do not get that message. The message you hear, again, mm-hmm. is look at the salaries, look at the jobs. The kid who graduates in computer science has a job even before he or she graduates. Meanwhile, the philosophy major is, you know, serving coffee at Starbucks. I mean, that's not the message that's out there.
Well, it's true that certainly engineering degrees or STEM degrees might end up with lifetime earnings slightly greater than those students who graduate with a liberal arts or a liberal education degree. But it's not that significant. And frankly, the jobs that those students fulfill as graduates of Franklin Pierce University or Colby Sawyer are just as necessary for, if you will, the fabric of society as students with science and engineering degrees. And we really do value that and try to articulate that for families.
And how do you make that argument? Again, that student who's, you know, nervous, he or she has, you know, doesn't want to be burdened with too much student debt. The mm-hmm. parents are worried. They don't want their child living in the basement mm-hmm. After graduation. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask you too, President Stubner, but make the case, President-elect Mooney. I'll use my teenager as an example. Mm-hmm. He loves history, mm-hmm. loves history. But as he gets towards, you know, high school graduation, still a couple years away, he's thinking, what am I going to do with a history degree? So,
well, what we're really understanding now from employers, from government officials, from people that are looking to hire for their businesses, they're interested in the depth of knowledge that students have, but the major itself, the selection of the major or the degree with which you've graduated, is not as important as the learning that was acquired over the course of your entire education across the entire curriculum. So when you make a commitment, as Franklin Pierce University has done, to articulating learning outcomes, those skills that employers are looking for in when they make hires, especially of young graduates, critical thinking, critical analysis, good communication skills, being able to work as a team member, being sensitive to intercultural differences, all of those skills, let's call them capacities or intellectual capacities, are valued, highly valued by future employers. And we talk about that with our prospective families and students.
I'd love to hear from you too on this, President Stubner.
Sure, absolutely. I think one of the things that we've found that helps a lot is again, telling those stories about outcomes. You know, your son or daughter who's 16, 17 and interested in a particular field might think they know what they want to do. But I think introducing our students and prospective students to here's the whole array of what our graduates are doing with a history degree. It might be law. It might be teaching. But then there might be five or six other things that, they couldn't even imagine. So telling those stories, today's generation really seems to resonate with those personal anecdotes and seeing what they do at, with a variety of degrees, not always what you'd predict.
So make the case to me. Let's say I'm a parent and I show up on your college and I think, you know, this is real interesting and it's beautiful here and I love your history program or your philosophy program or your English program. But the message I'm hearing is that I need a technical degree, that the U.S. is losing ground to South Korea or China. So just make the case for me that it's worth it for my kid to study philosophy.
Absolutely. I think, again, as President-elect Mooney shared, the kinds of skills that employers are looking for, critical thinking, communication skills, problem solving, being able to work with diverse groups, these are the things that employers really want. And so while you need those technical skills potentially to get that first job, if you want to be a leader in your field, if you want to manage people, if you want to have the ability to adapt as the world changes, many of us can't predict what our field is going to look like 10 years from now, even 5 years from now with technology. All of these wonderful liberal arts skills are the things that our students need to be those productive members of society and to be leaders in the variety of fields that we offer.
I'd love to hear from you too, Scott Carlson, on this issue of, you know, in an era dominated by talk of the need for STEM graduates, what do these smaller liberal arts education schools say in response to that?
Well, there have been some articles recently talking about how companies in Silicon Valley are looking toward liberal arts majors more and more because they do bring this kind of flexibility to the workplace that more technical majors don't bring. The problem that colleges have had in the past, I don't think this is so much true now, but in the past, is that, you know, you went to the small college, you majored in, say, philosophy or history, and at the end of your 4 years, the college gave you the degree, and they said, well, good job, good luck, and you went out the door, and there wasn't as much guidance for how to apply that. These days, at places like Colgate University, at places like Wake Forest, and a number of other smaller colleges, they're getting those students in, and in freshman and sophomore year, they're saying, okay, here are the majors. You want to major in history? That's fine. Here's what you can do with that. Let's get you an internship. Let's get you some experience. And then let's find ways to make that applicable to some sort of career after you get out.
How do you offer that internship? I'll turn to you first, President Steubner. You know, in New London, it's a small town. There's not a lot there. Nothing personal. It's beautiful. But how do you offer that real-world experience that students today are craving?
I think there's a couple different ways. I think within the general region, you'll be surprised that there are a lot of opportunities not that far away. One of our new really innovative programs is in Franklin Falls, where we have a 3-year community-based sustainability degree, where students from a whole variety of majors are doing internships, whether it's business plans, communications, graphic design, certainly our environmental studies on how to offer sustainable housing for multiple incomes. And so students from a vast array of majors are just immersing themselves in this experiential education where they get to apply the liberal arts skills we've just talked about with real life problems. The other main way is I think a lot of schools like us rely on our alumni for connecting with our students. It's a wonderful way for alums to give back and introduce them to whatever careers they're in. So it helps a lot.
Well, I'll ask you the same question, President-elect Mooney, in just a moment, and we'll start taking your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, small colleges, big challenges. As we're hearing nationwide, many smaller institutions are struggling in a changed higher education landscape. We're finding out more, getting some detail, and we're going to look at how some of them are adapting to this new landscape to survive and thrive. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Whether you're the graduate of a small college or looking at one for your own child, we'd love to hear from you, your comments, questions, concerns. 1-800-892-6477. Again, email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Scott Carlson. He joins us from D.C. He's senior writer with the Chronicle of Higher Education. With us in studio, President-elect Kim Mooney. She's the incoming president of Franklin Pierce University in Ringe. And also with us, President Susan Stubner. She's the president of Colby Sawyer College in New London. She just got started on July 1st. One more time, that exchange number for you to join us with your questions, comments, personal experiences, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And President-elect Mooney, same question for you. There's so much emphasis now on experiential learning, internships, but Franklin Pierce University is in Ringe, again, just like New London, lovely town, but pretty small. Mm-hmm. So how do you offer that for your students?
Well, our students often choose to do their internships during the summer. So when they go back home throughout the New England region and beyond, they'll conduct their internships then with supervision and oversight by the faculty. But I was interested in Scott's comment about career services and how critical that particular office has become to small colleges. We actually have a learning outcome for career exploration, and we put it right in our first-year program.
In the first year?
So we really want our students to understand that they, because of the emphasis on finding that great job right out of college and thinking about their career trajectories, we don't overemphasize it, but we let them know that we care very much about that for them, and we get them connected to career services. And the career services programs are offer extensive opportunities for first-year students and all students, really, to attend workshops. And to President Stubner's point about the importance of alumni, we are actually currently moving our career services and alumni office together so that our alums have more of an opportunity to directly interact with our undergraduate students and to bring back their wisdom and their experience in more meaningful ways on campus. So even though we're out there, what would be considered to be a rural part of the Monadnock region, our alums do come back to campus and they offer panels and expertise and support for the current students.
I have to ask both of you one more question, then we'll go to our listeners. It seems, at least from the headlines we hear, that this is an era when young people want to be in cities. They want the excitement. They don't want to drive. Certainly there's, you know, an opportunity and an energy and excitement there. President Stubner, to you first, what do you think? What's the sense of young people today considering a place like New London? It's a small, quiet town.
Yeah, I think there is a student that the city and the metropolitan area is certainly a good fit. But I think there are still plenty of students where having that campus feel where the town and the campus really is about you and your learning experience is still very attractive.
You don't get lost.
Exactly. And, you know, we can really personalize the educational experience for each of our students. It's not just that you won't be a number in a classroom. It's really we can get down to the individual level, get to know you so well that you may be a history major, but let's unpack that even further. You know, what do you really want to do? Our faculty and our staff know our students on a personal level and help them achieve their goals, which is really exciting.
Go ahead, President Mooney.
When I think about a small rural campus like the one we have in Ringe, we have graduate centers around the state, but Ringe is our main campus. And there are days in the spring I look out of my window or walk around the campus and I see students out on the lake in front in kayaks. And I know this is true for Colby Sawyer as well. There's a mountain day that you have. We also have a mountain climbing day. That is appealing. That outdoor opportunity, the recreation, you know, a different kind of recreation is appealing to a certain group of students. It's not for everyone. But there's also a safety factor, I think, that we think about. It's not that we can make every student safe at all moments. But there's something reassuring, I think, to families when they walk onto a campus that's small, that's rather contained, and they understand that we really are paying attention to their students. And we actually talk about Franklin Pierce University as a village because we really have to be on and available and ready for students 24/7. Being in a small rural environment.
Well, I hear you on the outdoor recreation part. Mm-hmm. I know several people my age who came to New Hampshire only because for school, only because there was skiing here. So let's go to our listeners. Again, the exchange number 1-800-892-6477. We're talking about the challenges and opportunities for small colleges these days. And as we're hearing, a lot of small colleges in New England have been struggling, or there are a fair number who have actually closed down in recent years. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, let's go to the phones. And Roberta joins us from Goffstown. Hi, Roberta. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. This I never make phone calls to talk radio.
Well, welcome, Roberta.
Thank you. Thank you. But I feel strongly about my experience in sending a son to a liberal arts college, Reed College in Portland, Oregon, and having a major in philosophy. And he's 31, and he's working as a videographer and video editor for a museum in New York City. And I truly believe the only reason he was able to obtain this job was because of his ability to speak, his ability to think, his ability to work in groups, and he was able to convey that in an interview. And I think we have Reed to thank for giving him those skills.
So here's a question for you, Roberta, if
sure.
I could. Sometimes these small private colleges are expensive and they don't
yes.
have the endowments, so they maybe can't give as much financial
exactly.
aid as the big ones. So how did
mm-hmm.
you navigate that?
Loans and savings, and mm-hmm. he's paying off his education.
Okay. Roberta, thank you so much for calling in. It's great to hear from you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. So, Scott, let's talk about the money. College is a big investment, as our caller says, you know, savings, loans, and so forth. What is the pricing system that especially is used by these smaller colleges? How the sticker price is not often the real price students pay?
Well, a college pricing system is a series of subsidies. I mean, any college, the way that the money works at a college is a series of subsidies. So the wealthier students are subsidizing the students who have not as much money. The wealthier students are paying more. And some of what they're paying is going into the college and then being routed in a kind of way to help pay for the students who are getting a lower price. They get a discount on the tuition. And the subsidy sort of works all across the board at a college. The business school or say another college program at the college that is making money subsidizes, say, the philosophy department or the poetry department or something like that. Colleges are built on subsidies, so the issue here is that the colleges need to know how to balance all of that money coming in and out. The problem at a lot of small colleges is that there just isn't the financial discipline at some of the weaker colleges that there should be. I'm looking at a place like Brunel University in Georgia, which knows down to the penny what it costs them to bring in and graduate a student in, say, nursing versus business versus history. And they use that information to try to move the money around to help keep everything afloat. At a lot of colleges, they get an infusion of cash twice a year, you know, in the fall and the spring, and they just kind of roll with it. And they don't really know where the money is going at that sort of detailed level.
Really? Even in this day and age when there's so much focus on the bottom line?
No. There is more focus now on the bottom line, but from what I've seen and from what I've reported on in the past at the Chronicle, you don't see the kind of financial discipline at some of these small colleges that you would see in, say, a for-profit business.
Go ahead. Did you want to say something else there, Scott?
Oh, you know, I was thinking about something that the caller just said about her son going to Reed College, and I just wanted to make a point on that. It's great. I mean, her son is probably going to do very well. He had a major that was not a technical major, and is now doing this, doing a job, and you know, seems to have launched very well. One thing I would say though is that her son went to Reed. Reed is a name college, an elite college in the country. It's harder, I think, for some families to justify when they are sending their students to, say, Defiance College. College in Defiance, Ohio, which many people have not heard of, or Midland University in the middle of Nebraska. You know, for those colleges, I think it's a tougher time, perhaps, to make the liberal arts sell.
Thanks again for that call, Roberta. And what do the two of you think, too? I'll turn to you first, President-elect Mooney. The idea that some small colleges don't have the financial discipline to really look at the dollars coming in, the dollars going out, and maybe you can only have 10 history majors this year.
Right. Well, at Franklin Pierce University, we have really engaged in significant financial discipline, and we are always looking at the bottom line for operations and beyond. What we're doing now is a cost analysis. We're developing a template that is going to we will be able to use going forward. But right now, we're using it to assess and evaluate all of our undergraduate academic programs, and that will allow us to get to that level of analysis that Scott mentioned. That we need to know the cost of the student coming in the door for particular academic programs, what it costs us to educate that person well, and once we really understand that broadly, we'll then take that template and apply it to other divisions of the university, from student life to athletics to even the finance office. So we're well aware that fiscal discipline is absolutely critical for small private universities.
At other schools, and I'm not sure what's happened at your two schools, but at other schools, sometimes when they apply that sort of green eye shade methodology, that's meant that certain schools have closed. So a student is studying a particular field of study, and then all of a sudden the numbers don't add up, and she finds out that, oh, we're no longer offering that degree. Mm-hmm. So I just wonder, does offering that level of financial scrutiny mean that you might have to close certain majors? Or
well, we certainly hope not. One of our philosophies using this method is to identify programs that may be struggling, that aren't really obvious yet to us, and to give them an opportunity to work with the academic administration and the marketing team to figure out a way to perhaps attract more students. So rather than go directly to, this doesn't seem to be working, let's move on from it, our first pass will be to try to support it in new or better ways to see if we can help strengthen the program. So that's the philosophy we've taken now.
I'd like to hear from you too, President Stubner. Yeah.
Sure. I think one of the biggest changes that I've seen in the last 10 years in my work as a senior officer at these types of colleges is the gap that Scott was talking about, some of the wealthier families subsidizing those with lower incomes, has really shrunk for schools of our ilk. Students coming from families with means are negotiating for financial aid in almost a rabid manner in ways that we had not seen before. They're very
really?
Savvy about the process. At my previous institution, we would have families call up and say, we expect X discount, and if you can't match that, this other school is. And so I think the enrollment management model, which includes financial aid in that negotiation, you really have to work very hard, because it's our primary source of revenue, to have a very solid enrollment management plan that includes how you're going to leverage financial aid to enroll your students. And it's
wow.
much more complicated than it used to be 5-10 years ago.
So, and we all know that, you know, not that many people pay the full sticker price. But you're saying, President Stubner, that people call you and say, you know, I'm expecting $30,000 off of this tuition, and if you can't give it to me, I'm going somewhere else. And
yes.
given the demographic struggles that we face in northern New England, you're inclined to try and make that happen.
It really depends. You know, I think, it puts the onus on us to really two things. We have to have a very sound financial aid strategy so that we go out with our best offer possible right from the beginning. And then the second piece is really articulating our value, the value proposition again, so that a family, by the time they get the financial aid package, understands, here's the value, here's why I want to invest in Colby Sawyer, and here's what the outcomes that might be for my son or daughter.
Did you want to jump in, too?
Well, I agree with what President Stubner is talking about, but I also think there's still a lot of confusion about college costs for families. So despite the fact that Franklin Pierce University offers some kind of educational discount for 100% of its undergraduates, that isn't enough information for families. They still need to know what the federal contribution might be. They still need to know what the loans and grant opportunities might be. So I think what happens at a small private institution is that we really try to take the time to work with those families, and we know it's not a one-size-fits-all solution for them. And so we try to provide a lot of individual attention and education about the cost of college and, frankly, about the debt of college, so that those families and their students know coming in the door, especially because they want to be at Franklin Pierce University and they know it might be a stretch for their families, we really do try to give them a sense of how to proceed, how to create a financial plan. We won't make the decision for them, but we try to provide for them all of the information they need, because it can be very confusing.
Yeah, overwhelming.
Even the out-of-pocket costs are hard to predict.
Our phone number again is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Your questions, comments, concerns about the status of small colleges today in New England, 1-800-892-6477. Julie's in Meredith. Hi, Julie. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call this morning. I had a comment just for the panel. I run a custom home building business in the Lakes region, and I recently hired a millennium right out of school. And I think what attracted me to hiring him is that he completed two full semesters of an internship. He went to Wentworth Institute down in Boston. And they're required to do, well, their year runs on a trimester, I believe, and one of those semesters they do a full internship. And that just gives a very real experience for the students, and they make them more, thus making them more attractive to employers to hire them. So I just wanted to share that. It was really important to us that they at least come out with some basic, how to work in an office, how to, do certain tasks, and the internship was a critical component to that.
Julie, good to hear from you, and thank you very much for calling. And Scott Carlson, we talked about this a little bit before, but we keep hearing it again and again. Anybody can get a job if they just start thinking about it earlier in when they're still in school and get some help from the career office, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, I think a big part of the reason why a student can get a job after college, though, has to do with experience. I mean, if you think about it, college prepares you in a certain way for the world. It provides a certain depth to your personality. It provides some knowledge that allows you to interact with people in a certain way. But most of the experience that you're going to have, that you're going to need to do the jobs that you do, you're actually going to get on the job. So that's actually a vital part of the experience in terms of getting a job. I think one of the things, though, that we need to look at, too, with regard to colleges is whether, she said that she worked for a home building company and had hired a millennial to do some work there, and it sounds like he was doing some office work there. I think we also need to take a hard look at whether, we need to send all 18 to 22-year-olds to a kind of four-year institution, or whether we can sort of have a broader idea of what college, quote-unquote college, means, whether that can be a technical institution or whether that can be some other kind of two-year institution as well as a four-year.
Well, thank you for that call. We'll take more in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, small colleges facing big challenges. And as we're hearing nationwide, many smaller institutions of higher education are struggling in a different landscape for higher ed today, especially here in New England. We're finding out more and how some of them are adapting to survive and thrive. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Scott Carlson with the Chronicle of Higher Education, I want to return to a point that you made just a minute ago, the idea that maybe these small colleges need to bust out of this four-year full-time mentality. And give us a little bit more there, Scott, if you could, please.
I'm not sure that the colleges need to bust out of the four-year mentality, but maybe the public does. When we say the word college, I want to send my kid to college, we immediately bring to mind schools like Colby Sawyer or Franklin Pierce, which is a good thing for them. That's great. Whether that's good for 18 to 22-year-olds generally? I'm not sure. I think that we should have sort of a broader idea of the kinds of education that's possible for those students that can include vocational education or career and what's called now is career and technical education, or some other kinds of very career-oriented kinds of fields. That's not necessarily going for the liberal arts education. I love liberal arts education. I was an English major that focused on utopian and dystopian fiction. Nothing could be more liberal artsy than that. But I think we do need a broader definition of what that means for kids leaving high school.
So don't necessarily shoehorn your own child into your bucolic, idealistic thought about what it means to go to college, Scott.
Yes.
Do you want to jump in on that? Oh, go ahead, Scott. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to know what President Steubner thought about that, too.
I think Scott's point is a great one. I mean, I think higher education is not a one-size-fits-all. And one of the great things about American higher education is the diversity of institutions
that
we have.
It is diverse.
Yeah.
And community colleges, two-year schools, big public schools, small schools like yours. Go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah. So there are going to be students that are not a great fit for Colby Sawyer, and we wish them well at an institution where it is. And so absolutely. And I think that Scott's point about other avenues is a great one, too.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call. This is Steve in Nottingham. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. I actually worked at a college that did go under, and I want to talk about what happened when you talked about some colleges don't make it. What I want to talk about is the human cost when a college closes, and I actually studied. I worked at Chester College in Chester, New Hampshire, and it was a wonderful small school, but it went under. And so what the students did and the faculty is they went through Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief, which is denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And it was a painful and horrible and interesting to observe what happens when a small school doesn't make it.
Well, you're right, Stephen. There are real human costs. The students have to figure out what to do. The faculty is out of a job. What happened at Chester College? I've got a list here that says it closed in 2012. So what happened?
Right. Well, we feel that, like many of the faculty members, which I was, we always blame it on the administration. But the fact of the matter is that we didn't have the enrollment. We didn't have the numbers. The location, we had some strong competition. But when we heard we were closing, there was phenomenal denial. No one believed it. Then we did all these things to try to get protests. We had auctions to raise money. We did all these things to try to stave it off. So I'm not sure what happened, but what happened is we did close, and it was when the alumni and students meet and other faculty, we're always feeling, oh, my God, what happened? And we feel bad.
Wow. Well, Steve, it's really good to hear from you. And, you know, you're right. There have been a number of closings in recent years here in New Hampshire, Chester College in 2012, Lebanon College in 2014, McIntosh College in Dover, 2009, Mount Washington College, formerly Hesser College in 2016, Notre Dame College in Manchester. That one got a lot of publicity. That was in 2002, St. John International University in 2014. So lots of schools have shut down. I wonder what you think, Scott Carlson, about Steve's comment that, you know, it's really tough. There's a human toll when these schools close.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a devastating story at some level because, yes, there are a number of employees that are left behind, particularly among the faculty who may, I don't know the story at Chester, but may have hung their hopes for a tenured position at that college. And what you see, what you saw, what he described at Chester there is what you see it happening at Sweetbriar. It's what happened at Antioch College in Ohio when those places closed. People galvanized at the last minute and they said, no, this place can't close. And they tried, did everything they could to keep it alive. Both of those colleges reopened and we'll see if they survive. But, you know, this kind of galvanizing that happens, it should happen a lot earlier than in the last moments of a college's life. Another thing I would bring up here, though, is that, you know, when these small colleges close, it's not just the people who work there and the alumni who are hurt. There are so many towns across the United States where the college is sort of the last sort of economically viable institution in the town. There are places like Utica, New York, where Utica College is, or Oberlin, Ohio, where Oberlin College is. You know, all across the Rust Belt and in the Northwest, this is sort of the last thing that that employs people in the town. And if the college goes out of business, the town dies. This was one of the main things that people in Yellow Springs, Ohio, worried about when Antioch College closed. I was there right after it closed. I was reporting on the college's demise. And I went around to the townsfolk, and where there was a nice pizza place and sort of very college-oriented businesses. And they said, you know, what do we do now?
Who it's like a factory closing down.
Yeah. What do we do now? And if we want to get out of here, how do we sell our homes? Who's going to move to the middle of Ohio where there's no more college?
Wow. You know, I bet this keeps you up at night, President-elect Mooney, and you're not even in office yet. But so obviously it's dire, not only for the students, for the people who work there, but as Scott describes, for the town. Ringe, for example, I mean, I'm sure Franklin Pierce University is a major employer. What do you do, given these challenges, the demographic challenges, the STEM challenges we talked about earlier, the financial challenges? What are some of the creative ideas that you hope to bring to the table to prevent this sort of nightmare scenario from happening?
Well, Franklin Pierce has a long history of introspection and resilience. And we are well aware of our challenges, and we think about them and work on them all of the time. And I think one of our great responses to the changing landscape in higher education has been to diversify our academic portfolio. We are entering our 10th year as a university, as opposed to Franklin Pierce College. And that has really allowed us to look at opportunities at the undergraduate and graduate levels to create a curriculum that really resonates with families and students. And we've also worked very hard to create pathways from that undergraduate curriculum to the graduate curriculum. So students walking in the door at the age of 18, unlike most of us, perhaps in my generation, when we went to college, and President Stubner and I were saying this earlier, we didn't really feel we had to know what we wanted to do. But there's more pressure now, and students and their families feel like they need to know the major as soon as they walk in the door, and they need to know the job that's going to come out of that major, or they need to know the graduate degree that they're going to pursue. And we've really tried to address that through the way that we've diversified our academic portfolio. So,
what about partnering with other sort of area institutions here in New England? I mean, luckily, we're a small region, so I think you guys have some unique partnerships with other organizations. Not necessarily your institutions of higher education, but yeah, go ahead.
Right. I mean, one of our new partnerships is with the Boston Herald, our polling organization, our polling operation. We've had great success with that this past year during the presidential cycle, and we are going to continue that partnership. Our priority for that partnership was to make sure our students would have great educational opportunities. And the Boston Herald is a fantastic partner in that regard, and they really understand that the educational opportunities and outcomes are a priority whenever you put students into that kind of professional environment. We really want them to learn a lot, and they have. So they've written articles for the Boston Herald. They've been on Boston Herald Radio. The Boston Herald invited our students to attend the Iowa caucuses with them.
Wow.
So it's been a wonderful opportunity for students, and we will continue through the presidential elections as well.
Well, so what are you doing, President Stubner, to avoid that nightmare scenario that Steve from Nottingham painted for us?
Absolutely. I think there's really two tracks the presidents have to manage today. One is really just paying very close attention to the fundamentals, the enrollment management, the financials, that day-to-day operations that we can never lose sight of. And then the other time is thinking strategically, really sorting out what are we going to be good at? If we try to do it all, we're not going to do anything well. And so,
well, that's a good point, too. You can't do everything.
Right.
So how do you approach that? Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things as being a new president, we will engage in a strategic planning process. There have been some things that have been added at Colby Sawyer, and we really want to take a hard look at, you know, which are the right ones for our mission that we really want to, again, really invest in and pursue and do well. The School of Nursing and Health Professions has been an area for us that's been really growing. We have a wonderful partnership with Dartmouth Hitchcock that we're all our clinicals for our nurses, and they've given some ideas for other majors. And so those partnerships, I think, that President-elect Mooney mentioned, they're really critical for small colleges like us because we don't have the endowments or the resources to always do it like a Reed College might be able with more resources available.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from you too, Scott. The idea that small colleges especially really need to look at what they do and what they do well. Maybe they want to diversify, but they can't make massive investments in everything, as President Stubner says, because it's too expensive. They have to be really careful about this.
Yeah, I mean, the buffet model, the buffet-style model of higher education is something that's very hard to pull off if you're a small college. I mean, to offer everything to everybody. If you're a small college, you basically have to focus on what is it that we do really well, where are our strengths, and what is it that we do differently from other colleges around us. And if you can't offer everything, that's okay. What we've referred to here recently in the conversation are partnerships. So I think what we'll see in the future is more small colleges partnering on various things. That could be academic-oriented things. So, for example, academic programs, not everyone can offer German, for example, or Arabic. Maybe one college will offer that, and then two other colleges will join in and send students there. Back office kinds of things, HR, maybe IT kinds of services, colleges could share those sorts of things. And finally, what you may see more of in the future, which is always a hard thing for colleges to do, are outright mergers. There have been some mergers in recent years and many, many attempted mergers. But the problem is that, you know, if you have a small college that's really desperate, like Burlington College wanted to do a merger, but it was in a desperate situation, it's hard for another college to come in and say, hey, we want to acquire that college. What's the sale there? There's really no appeal.
Here's an email from Christina, who says, I'm a proud graduate of Sterling College in Craftsbury Common, Vermont, a tiny, tiny college, she says. The only regret I have is such high debt, since small schools have little endowment. Christina says, even so, the experiential education I received was invaluable. Christina, thank you for the email. And I did want to return all of you to this cost question. And to you first, please, Scott. So we talked about how often the sticker price is kind of a shocker, but then you dig a little more and it turns out nobody really pays the sticker price. Why not, Scott? Why not just cut all the confusion and the, you know, having to seek aid and get tough on the phone and seek loans? Why not just lower the cost if nobody's paying the full sticker price anyway?
Now, there's a debate about that among higher education consultants who advise institutions about this, and among higher education institutions themselves. For example, Converse College in South Carolina did what's called a tuition reset. Basically, nobody at the college was paying the sticker price. Let's say that, I don't know what the sticker price was there, but they were, let's say it was $30,000. No one was paying that. Everyone was paying maybe around, on average, around 15. So Converse said, hey, we can make ourselves more appealing if we just get rid of the sticker price and we just have everyone pay 15. We'll look cheaper than everyone else and we'll get a nice bump out of it.
Sure. Did it work?
They did get a bump out of it. Whether that bump lasts is one of the debates. So you get a bump out of it out of the first couple of years. If it's not managed well, then you go right back to where you were, and then you're charging less than everyone else. You're not getting you don't have the ability to charge wealthier students more. So you know, it's a tough situation. Folks say that some of the consultants who work on this say, look, there's great power in the psychology of going to a family and saying, hey, you know, our sticker price is $30,000, but we're going to give it to you for $20,000 because we like you so much. That has an appeal when you're trying to compete against other institutions.
Right. But you do have to, as a student and a family, doing that initial search, Scott, you have to figure that out on your own. It doesn't show up on the, you know, when you make that first Google search of affordable colleges.
Yeah, and there's a lot of research that has to go into it on the college's part if they want to try one of these tuition resets. There have been colleges that have tried it and didn't do a lot of research on it, and it failed miserably.
Wow. President Stubner, what do you think? Again, if everybody gets aid and nobody pays full price, why not just lower the full price?
Absolutely. I think you can't underestimate the psychology on this. And again, the complexity of this is very hard to articulate. We have seen many times in managing enrollment the last several years where another institution's sticker price will be higher thus the merit scholarships will be $25,000 versus $20,000, the net price to come to our institution might actually be less, but the bragging rights of that parent and that student to be able to say, X institution wants my son or daughter so much, they gave me $25,000 versus something slightly smaller. As President-elect Mooney described earlier, it's so critical for our financial aid offices to walk each student through, here's how much it's actually going to cost, and that takes time. And not
every. Would it be easier to just lower it?
As Scott mentioned, there are several schools that have tried it, and the data that I've seen is that you might get a 1 or 2 year bump, but then enrollments have dropped vastly, and you know the impact on the risk for our institutions. You can't be the lone wolf trying that path. It's too risky, in my opinion.
Do you want to jump in with some quick thoughts there, President-elect Mooney?
Well, I think there's also the public perception that has to be considered. You know, why this sudden drop in tuition costs? And I would imagine families would have more questions than we might have answers. And so there's also the possibility of a little bit of a reverse psychology. They might walk away from it thinking that there's something hidden going on with that kind of change in tuition rates.
Wow. Yeah. Well, we could have talked a lot more. Thank you all so much for being with us. Scott Carlson, it was great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Scott Carlson, senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education. We also had with us in studio President-elect Kim Mooney at Franklin Pierce University and President Susan Stubner, the new president of Colby Sawyer College in New London. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our producer is Jessica Hunt. Our intern is Sam Ruthier. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. And I'm Laura Kanoy.